Welcome to Open Spaces. Willow Belden is away. I'm Bob Beck. This week, Governor Matt Mead told the legislature's Joint Appropriations Committee that he is proposing cutting $60 million out of the current state budget, and he wants to eliminate a number of vacant government positions. He also wants to build the legislative savings account up to $3 billion, raise gas taxes by 10 cents a gallon, and he opposes expanding Medicaid services in the state. Legislators have mixed reactions about the governor's key proposals.
Overpayment, if you will, of insurance premiums.
As Governor Matt Mead spoke to the legislature's Joint Appropriations Committee, he admitted that some of the cuts could be painful, but he says they were necessary because Wyoming is getting less energy revenue and the state budget has doubled over the last 10 years. A quick history lesson. At the end of the 1990s, the Wyoming legislature was facing a budget shortfall of roughly $100 million. But thanks to the coal bed methane boom and overall gas development, the state saw revenues increase dramatically, and the legislature now has a bank account of around $2 billion that's being saved for the next bust. But with all that money came a lot of spending. Appropriations Committee member Sue Wallace says lawmakers went a little over the top.
We were rolling in the dough from the energy industry, when there's money there, the inclination is to spend it.
Yeah, state government has grown over that period of time, but so has everything else. I don't think it's just a bunch of drunken sailors spending money.
That is Senator Tony Ross of Cheyenne, who will become the Senate president in January. He was in the House of Representatives during the 90s and noted that the state fell behind in basic construction and was unable to fund a number of necessary services. When the fiscal situation improved, he says some of the money went to update buildings and roads that were neglected over time. And the legislature added some programs. For instance, the state made it possible to expand developmental disability and mental health services, among other things. Speaker of the House Ed Buchanan also says the spending was justified, and he is confident that the growth has leveled off.
We did spend in a lot of places that needed appropriation. You know, we did a lot of great things over the past 10 years, and so naturally you're going to see a little bit of budget creep. But conversely, when times get a little bit leaner, we'll rein it back a little bit and live within our means like we always have.
But how far should they cut? Buchanan is not positive that proposed 6% cuts are needed. He says things can change quickly, though, so he thinks the governor's proposal is a good starting point for legislators. Incoming House Appropriations Committee Chairman Steve Harshman says it's less about cuts and more about limiting increases. But Cheyenne Democrat and the incoming House Minority Floor Leader Mary Throne says it's crazy to talk about cuts when the state has so much money in the bank. She also strongly opposes the governor's plan to build up the legislative savings account to $3 billion.
We don't need to just amass huge sums of money without discussion. No one's ever given me a white paper or any sort of analysis as to why that's necessary. We collect taxpayer money to provide necessary government services. It's sort of absurd. We're not going to need the $3 billion at once.
Throne also claims that had the legislature put income from the Permanent Mineral Trust Fund into the state's general fund, no cuts would be needed. And then there is the Medicaid expansion issue. For decades, Wyoming has looked at ways to reduce Medicaid spending. But an analysis by the State Department of Health shows that if the state expands Medicaid services, Wyoming would conservatively save $50 million. That's because the federal government would start paying for services that Wyoming currently provides. Over the years, few people have been more concerned about state spending than former Senate Appropriations Chairman John Schiffer. He told a recent hearing that the state cannot afford the $50 million it will have to spend if it doesn't take the federal money.
We're going to spend $50 million for a lesser product, an additional $50 million. Now, you wouldn't do that in business. You don't do that in your own household. But we as legislators will do it. And that doesn't make sense to me.
Cheyenne Representative Ken Esquivel agrees.
I think if there's any opportunity to supplant general fund money that we're currently using in other programs with federal money, that we should not be walking away from that. We should be running to it.
One last point. The governor also suggested reallocating some of his proposed budget cuts to use on other spending. Encampment Republican Jeb Stuart says that happened when the state made 10% cuts a few years ago, and he claims that actually led to few reductions. In fact, he thinks some of that money may have been used to enhance other areas of state government. He says if you're going to reduce the budget, reduce the budget.
With these cuts, we create these false revenues that is available for appropriation that contributes, again, to that growth in government.
Needless to say, there will be a lot of discussion when the full legislature gets its hands on the proposed budget in coming weeks. Tim Considine is a professor at the University of Wyoming and director of the Center for Energy Economics and Public Policy. He's done research on petroleum markets and written about Powder River Basin coal. He helped organize a roundtable discussion about coal called Powder River Basin Coal: Domestic Challenges and International Opportunities, which took place this week in Gillette. He said the industry has been facing challenges like ongoing uncertainty in regulations, yet coal exports are at record levels. He told Wyoming Public Radio's Irina Zhorov that for him, there was more good than bad.
I actually came away thinking that the coal industry, and particularly the Powder River Basin coal industry, is in perhaps better shape than I had first thought going into the meeting. Because Powder River Basin coal producers are probably the lowest cost producers of coal on the planet. And if anyone can weather this storm, they can. And also, a lot of the regulations that have been proposed have been modified, especially in light of the costs and benefits and their technical feasibility. And in particular, I was also quite impressed with the sort of steady resolve that the coal industry is showing in opening up export markets for Wyoming coal. I had not realized that there are $100 million investments that are being made to expand port capacity on the West Coast. And when companies put that amount of capital at stake, they want to see it through.
You know, at the same time, in Washington and Oregon, yesterday they were having public hearings regarding the new terminals that are being proposed.
Right.
And for at least from what I've read, there seems to be a lot of negative feedback. Well, what are some of the challenges that actually face increasing exports for a place like Wyoming?
Well, transport and access, and when you're dramatically ramping up the volume of coal that's being shipped out, local communities near the ports see increased rail traffic, noise, congestion, that sort of thing. But the design of the port facilities and the upgrading that's going on will seek to minimize a lot of those impacts.
And the university and the state and industry have all invested a lot of money in research to keep Wyoming coal viable through perhaps new incarnations like clean coal technologies.
Yeah.
Was that a bright spot as well during the presentations, or was it discussed much?
Yes, it was discussed. It's a key issue. You know, if we're going to use coal long term, we have to do something about the greenhouse gas emissions. Everyone recognizes that. The problem is that there is no way to price carbon in the United States. There's no permit system like there was in SO2, and there's no carbon tax, so there's no market signal. And right now, carbon dioxide is used to enhance oil production in several regions in the United States, but the value of that carbon dioxide is just not sufficient to cover the costs of capturing it at power plants and transporting it to the field. So there's a gap there. And everyone recognizes that there's a gap. And that was perhaps one of the lowlights. In my summary comments, I said, well, everyone agrees that we have to price carbon, but there's no clear path to get there. And even the EPA is struggling with this issue. You know, I came away with we have to be very aware and careful of how regulations are designed to provide adequate market incentives to get companies and universities productively producing technologies that will capture carbon and clean up the environment.
Can you talk a little bit more about what came out of the, you know, the roundtable rather than the presentations?
Yeah, the roundtable was chaired by Sean Andrikopoulos, who's an ultra petroleum visiting professor here at the university. Sean asked a great question, put everyone on the spot. Where is PRB coal going to be in 5 years? The most pessimistic assessment was production would be just about where it is now. And the consensus was that production would grow in the next 5 years. And I think a lot of that is driven by expectations for export markets.
Mm-hmm.
The number one growth fuel in the world over the past 10 years has been coal. And it's expected that there will be another billion tons of new coal consumption in Asia over the next 10 years. That's a big number. And that's got to come from somewhere, and Wyoming would likely be a supplier of that.
What about domestically? There was a presentation about what the industry can expect from a second term with President Obama.
Yes.
What did the speakers come up with regarding that?
His assessment was what EPA proposed for greenhouse gas emission controls for power plants. His assessment was that rule would not stand. It would be defeated in court. We'll mm-hmm. see. I don't know what to make of it. The other, when we talk domestically, the big issue, you know, a lot of people will blame the regulations, and regulations play a role. But the real culprit in reduced coal use in the United States has been cheap natural gas. And there was a month, I think, earlier this spring, it was April 2012, where coal and gas generated an equal amount of power, and that hasn't happened ever before. So the real key question for the outlook for PRB coal producers and coal producers in the United States is, what is the price of natural gas going to be?
When we come back, we'll hear about how some Jackson residents are reacting to the fiscal cliff, and we'll hear from State Treasurer Mark Gordon. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck. While the fiscal cliff has cast a dark shadow over the nation's economy, for some there's what you might call a platinum lining. Individuals or families who own estates or businesses worth $5 million can cash in on what appears to be a chance of a lifetime. But the clock is ticking. Rebecca Huntington has more.
Good afternoon, Long Reimer Weiniger Bepler. This is Hannah.
The phone rings a lot these days at this law firm located in a sleek new building on Jackson's Pearl Avenue. Among the attorneys working here is Christopher Reimer, who specializes in estate tax law.
Phone has essentially been ringing off the hook with people scrambling to learn about the so-called fiscal cliff changes in the estate tax realm.
Reimer says many clients are scrambling to take advantage of the current tax law before either the fiscal cliff or a deal to avert that cliff changes the tax code. He says what's at stake are millions of dollars.
We're describing it as a chance of a lifetime.
For decades, tax law allowed estates to transfer just $675,000 before paying any taxes.
It then jumped up to $1 million and crept its way up to $3.5 million, which was the rule in 2009.
Then things got a little wacky.
We then had a weird year, which was 2010, where you could actually die and have an unlimited estate. You could transfer an unlimited amount. Now, the really bad news about that is you had to die to do it.
That's because Congress let the estate tax expire. Although Congress quickly reinstated the tax, lawmakers raised the amount of assets that could be passed from one generation to the next without paying any taxes.
So if you are a person that has $5 million, today you can call your lawyer and go in and make a transfer and pay zero tax.
Reimer says that $5 million tax exemption is unprecedented, and it will sunset at the end of this year. If lawmakers take no action, the tax exemption reverts to $1 million. Even if Congress and President Obama reach a deal to reform the tax code and avoid the fiscal cliff, Reimer says he expects the exemption to decrease. So that means the clock is ticking, and many families are facing tough conversations about whether or not to pass on their family business.
Ranchers tend not to like the idea of giving up ownership and control over to the next generation. So that's the delicate conversation and plan that we try to help the family work with. And this year, there's a tremendous pressure to do it that there wouldn't be in a normal year.
Reimer says it's not an easy decision, especially for younger clients who have built up a business worth $5 to $10 million and are not quite ready to retire.
The first thing I tell people is you have to want to give this away. If you'd rather just spend it for the rest of your life, then don't give it away. But people hate taxes.
Reimer says the dilemma is leading clients and attorneys to come up with some pretty creative estate plans to allow them to transfer their assets while still maintaining some kind of control or ability to draw income from those assets.
And all sorts of planning mechanisms have really cropped up this year.
Plans that, for example, give away an asset but retain the ability to still draw future income from it. With so many millions at stake, Reimer expects to be working on such complicated plans right up until the new year. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Rebecca Huntington in Jackson.
State Treasurer Mark Gordon took over his new duties a few weeks ago following the death of Joe Meyer. Gordon has an extensive background on issues involving finances to state lands. He tells us that Wyoming's portfolio looks good.
The state has done a great job in diversifying not only the assets that it's invested in, but it's also done a great job in the strategies. So I think we're well positioned at a time in our nation's economy and global economy that has a lot of, I suppose, ups and downs ahead of it. You know, there's a lot of talk about the fiscal cliff. There's a lot of talk about Europe. A little bit unclear what's happening in China. But we have a very, very diversified approach and portfolio that puts the investment picture, which is the third most important component of Wyoming's revenue stream, kind of puts it in good stead. In terms of our natural gas and our coal, you know as well as I do, those are challenged a little bit at this point.
How active are you going to be on issues like that? Do you see yourself as in a role where you can educate third parties, or rather be that third party that can educate folks? Because obviously, using the legislature as an example, they'll frequently hear from the coal industry lobbyists, and then you'll have the environmental groups and those kinds of people adding to the discussion. Do you see yourself as being someone who could maybe come in and add some discussion to this?
Bob, I hope to. This office really talks about the state's financial health and fiscal matters are a little bit out of our control. But I do, as you know, have spent a lot of time and care a lot about the state and have a lot of experience broadly, both in agriculture. I worked for an oil and gas company. I have had spent time on the Environmental Quality Council, so I have a familiarity with a lot of those issues. I always try to go to what I always thought of as Wyoming's traditional values, stewardship, use of our natural resources, but a stewardship that you know, I go back clear to Stan Hathaway and Tom Strook and Malcolm Wallop, you know, those kinds of voices that talked about Wyoming's economic future being dependent on its minerals to some degree, but also being very, very much dependent on our wise stewardship of those resources. So I try to bring a very practical standpoint, a knowledgeable standpoint. And I do look forward to that ability. We've already, as you know, in this capacity, one of the state's five elected statewide positions. We have several boards we sit on: State Board of Land Commissioners, the State Land or Loans and Investment Board, and a lot of natural resources issues come before us. So I'm happy I can bring that experience with me, and I've really enjoyed working with our governor and the other members in that capacity. And I think I have brought a very practical standpoint.
State Treasurer Mark Gordon chatting with us. So as we look at coal, going back to that, you know, one of the stories that we were able to get out last week was about the exports going overseas, maybe seeing that as a way that I guess could help that industry. Do you really see that as an important thing?
You know, I do, Bob. I think there's obviously, if you look from an environmental standpoint, there's obviously that issue about carbon. And I think, you know, globally and internationally, there's a lot of discussion about that. And to some degree, that's challenged our industries. The exports, I'll tell you, quite frankly, China is going to get coal from somewhere. They're going to get oil from somewhere. If you look at Canada, you know, the XL pipeline gave the opportunity for Chinese firms to come into Alberta and BC and buy huge positions of oil up there. I think the same thing is a problem for potentially Wyoming. If we can get our resources to the coast, and we can do that in a safe fashion and in an efficient fashion, then we can export those. And hopefully, with the kind of work that our legislature has thought about over the last few years, that our governor has thought about over the last few years, and the governor preceding him, talking about the opportunity for clean coal, which I know the environmental community will say there is no such thing as clean coal. But frankly, I think we're going to have to figure out a way to use coal, use it efficiently, and use it in a way that is not problematic for the environment.
I want to ask you about the fiscal cliff. You touched on that a second ago, but what are you watching for as you look at our state investments and our state portfolio, and how might that affect us here, and what are you taking a close look at right now?
Well, yeah, you know, the issue there is, can Congress come to some understanding that will avoid having the sequestration, which is the elimination of the funding of various things like the military and so on, and the taxation issues along with some other features. So it's a little hard to know what Congress can or cannot get done. I do believe that the markets to some degree have anticipated and priced in that there will be some resolution of this process. And I think it's anybody's guess exactly what that'll be, but I think the feeling is that while it probably won't be resolved by the end of this year completely, there will be some resolution that comes forward. So what's important for the state to position itself in is the ability to have its assets not all correlated with one particular resolution or another. So that means a broad-based and diversified strategy that has both hedging components to it, some fixed income components to it. It has the state in a nimble position of being able to say, you know, we probably won't get all of this right, but let's get 90% of it right or 80% of it right, and let's make sure the state rides through this pretty well. I think really the challenges are going to come a little bit further down the road. We've done some things from the Federal Reserve standpoint that are putting distortions in the market. And to try to resolve those issues, that, you know, there, for example, right now, I think there is this notion that if we keep putting money into the system, that somehow we're going to improve the employment rates. Well, it's not a direct relationship. What a lot of those investments, what a lot of the extra money that's gone out there has gone into investing in is productivity enhancement. So it hasn't really affected the labor market. But it has done things to have people pursue riskier and riskier investments because that's where the yields are better. It has made life much more difficult for banks, much more difficult for insurance companies. And we're all kind of trying to figure out how to make money out of this environment, and it's an unnatural environment. It's one that's going to take some effort on the part of the Federal Reserve and the federal government to be able to unwind that. And when we unwind that, It's a little unclear what the results will be.
Mark Gordon, State Treasurer, we'll be chatting with you more in the future. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Bob. Great to see you.
When we come back, we'll discuss the future of libraries in the state and talk a little alcohol. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. With the federal election concluded, many members of Congress are back to disagreeing over the issue of immigration reform. Wyoming's delegation has an interest in that debate. Matt Laszlo reports from Washington.
Wyoming's immigration issues are different than those faced in other parts of the country. Seasonal workers are needed to help staff up the tourism industry. But Congresswoman Cynthia Lummis points out a less well-known reason the state needs migrant workers.
Wyoming has a strong sheep industry. Sheep herders from some South American countries and from Mongolia are the very best sheep herders in the world.
Without a robust guest worker program, many of those sheep herders find it hard getting into Wyoming legally. Lummis says it's time for Congress to tackle immigration reform.
There's a big problem in our country with people who want to become legal citizens, and the process is so bogged down that they cannot utilize our legal immigration system. And so some of them resort to the illegal immigration system.
Wyoming Senior Senator Mike Enzi says the lack of immigration reform has also kept the state from employing foreign students.
And we also have kids that graduate from the University of Wyoming with some significant degrees, and then we kick them out of the country, and they could make a contribution.
A few years ago, a bipartisan group of policymakers came together to push an immigration overhaul through Congress. The effort was derailed, and leaders of both parties shelved the topic. But many Republicans, who were mostly silent on immigration for the past 2 years, gained a new sense of urgency after this year's returns came in showing Latinos voted overwhelmingly for Democrats.
We have to get this ball rolling. We have to have a discussion that is sensible, that is calm.
Arizona Republican Senator John Kyle was one of the first lawmakers to unveil a new proposal after the election. His legislation would allow children of undocumented workers a path to permanent residency, but not the citizenship promised in the Democrats' Dream Act. Critics say that's because GOP leaders don't want to create millions of new Democratic voters. Besides what to do with immigrant children, there's also the estimated 12 million undocumented workers in the U.S., a problem Congresswoman Lummis is acutely aware of.
It is a big problem, it's a big issue, and we should ignore it for now.
She says if lawmakers focus on contentious issues, a divided Congress won't be able to make any gains on immigration.
We need to focus on the areas where we can agree, where there's some bipartisan and bicameral agreement, and let that one big issue that could really prevent good things from happening in other areas of immigration law, we just need to let it go for now.
Senator Enzi echoes Lummis' concerns about trying to fit every issue into one massive catch-all bill. He says it would just die on the vine.
Well, you know, we worked on it before, and had we broke it down into a step-by-step process instead of a comprehensive one, I think we'd have made great progress and had some good immigration reform. But we're going to try and do it comprehensive again. When you do something comprehensive, there are always a few votes that get peeled off for each of the different things that are in there, and you wind up without a majority, and you wind up just like we did last time.
But a piecemeal approach doesn't seem good enough for many Democrats, especially members of the Congressional Hispanic Caucus. The caucus laid down a 9-point proposal on immigration reform. It includes establishing an employee verification system, a commitment to securing the borders, and a path to citizenship. Arizona Democratic Congressman Raul Grijalva is a leading Hispanic voice in Congress. He says he's glad Republicans are offering proposals, but he says unless Republicans broaden their scope, they're going to continue angering Hispanic voters.
So the wool's not going to get pulled over the Latino voters. If it's an honest gesture with content and with an effort toward compromise, I think the Republican Party, their efforts would be respected. But if the, you know, this continues to try to just buy time and not deal with the reality, the drubbing they took is just going to be historic as time goes on.
Grijalva and others are drawing their line in the sand on offering a path to citizenship to undocumented workers in the U.S.
We're not going to create a second-class citizenship or a marginalized group of workers in this country. That is just un-American, against all the values, and that is one of the lines.
As for Republicans, many also have their line in the sand. Here's Wyoming Senator John Barrasso's.
First, you have to secure the border, and there are different ways to do that, but the border isn't secure yet.
In January, the 113th Congress will be seated. The new session offers lawmakers in both parties a fresh opportunity to negotiate a solution to the nation's immigration woes, though immigration groups worry Republicans will block the effort. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
The Wyoming library system has been working hard to keep up with residents' needs in the digital age, but they might have some trouble if the legislature approves sweeping budget cuts in January. Wyoming Public Radio's Rebecca Martinez spoke with the Wyoming State Librarian, Leslie Boughton, about it. Boughton says the Wyoming library system works well because of how it was created.
Back in 1886, a former governor, John Hoyt, he was the third territorial governor, suggested that the county would be the best unit for library services in Wyoming. And at that time, there were eight counties. And what's particularly interesting is that a bill was introduced, House Bill 6, was introduced in the territorial legislature in 1886 by Mr. Towne of Laramie, T-O-W-N-E. He was serving in that territorial legislature. And that established county libraries. And that has been such a wonderful boon for us because we have 23 counties now, 23 county libraries, extremely collaborative and able to work together in ways that doesn't occur in many other states. I look at my colleagues in Nebraska and Iowa. They are dealing with as many as 500 small independent libraries, and it's much more difficult to deliver effective service to all residents when you have so many small units.
So I am curious because, you know, most people have access to internet in their homes and on their phones these days. What do most patrons come to the library for these days?
Well, you know what's interesting is people have thought that the internet could make libraries obsolete. And really that has not happened at all. Libraries have been transformed by technologies and by changes in people. And the internet has also transformed us. We are able to deliver more services to people where they are by using the internet effectively. People still come into the library because they like a quiet place to find materials, to sit and read. A lot of people still like the print book, but the internet's enabling us to offer e-resources, e-books. People come into libraries with their devices and librarians help them use them. Libraries are still doing terrific work with children's programming, really engaged in early literacy. Libraries provide computers for people who do not have home computers or who may not have good bandwidth or it's only dial-up. I'm amazed at the number of businesses and industry that require online applications so that people who don't have that home computer can come into the library and still prepare an online application for employment. So just myriad things.
What are other ways that technology has influenced or changed the services that you offer or how you deliver it?
Well, one of the most interesting things, particularly from the state library perspective, is we're engaged in creating digital content. We have digitized over 350 of Wyoming's historical newspapers from 1886 up to 1922 because they are all in the public domain. So in the past, you would have to come to a library and look at newspapers on microfilm. You can now have access to those wherever you are, any place in the world. We have opened up Wyoming's history that way. We are also digitizing all of the legislative digests. We have created a database full of trademarks, a database of Wyoming inventions. So in that way, technology has helped us open up all of these resources, which were primarily closed unless people came to Cheyenne and made those available absolutely statewide. So that's been, a really valuable service.
Now, with the legislative session around the corner, I know a lot of state agencies are worried about budget cuts. How might cuts affect the library system across the state?
Well, we're concerned about the potential that they will freeze or eliminate positions. That has happened to us in the past. Our deputy director had retired. before we were able to advertise and fill that position, the legislature froze and then eliminated it. That's really hard on us because we are all having to step up to the plate and to do more. We've not had any increase in our general fund appropriation at the State Library for the last three biennia. We use some of that money to purchase licenses to electronic resources, and those prices are going up constantly, and we're very hard-pressed to keep up with that. One of the things that is important about the electronic resources is we license them for statewide use, which means that the same opportunity to access this important information is given to people in Niobrara County, in Hot Springs County, as it is in Laramie or Albany County. And that does concern me. The second piece is that our federal money, which also goes into electronic resources and training, we started our fiscal year, our federal fiscal year, October 1, and we have still had no information as to whether or not we will have an appropriation of federal money or what it will be. If we were not to receive federal money, we would have to dramatically curtail the purchase and licensing of electronic resources. And that means that the people of Wyoming would not have access to those, and I don't think that local libraries could pick up the costs. Certainly none of the smaller libraries, maybe some of the mineral-rich counties, but definitely not the smaller libraries. So it would have a pretty apparent impact.
So is there anything else that I should know, either about what the state library system's doing or what might lie ahead?
We are seeing the retirement of long-term directors like Susan Simpson of Albany County, and there are opportunities for younger people to move into libraries. And that will change. You know how new blood changes the way things operate. I think we see libraries becoming more and more centers for community activity outside of what we would think of traditional library service. But you will find libraries offering classes in not just using computers, you know, the mouse, et cetera, but in digital literacy, how to access and utilize information. We're seeing libraries participate more in workforce development, partnering with other agencies in terms of early literacy. So it's very exciting.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Leslie Boughton is the State Librarian of Wyoming.
Business has been booming for the Wyoming Liquor Division. The arm of the State Department of Revenue distributes all wine and liquor to retailers across the state. And over the last 7 years, there's been a huge increase in the amount of alcohol sold and the revenue that's coming back to the Cowboy State. Wyoming Public Radio's Rebecca Martinez has the story.
Well, this shows you only the good die young.
The bar at the Four Winds Liquor and Lounge in Cheyenne is lined with bottles of all shapes and sizes. I should say, jam-packed. Each shelf is chock-full of bottles, each of a different kind. Owner J.J. Moran says it looks a lot different than it did when he bought the Four Winds in the 1970s.
We didn't have near the selection that you have now. You didn't have small-batch bourbons. You didn't have flavored vodkas. And Captain Morgan Spiced Rum is the one that kind of started the ball rolling on flavored alcohol. And now I have bacon vodka here. Bacon vodka. Can you imagine that? Marshmallow vodka.
When you went to a liquor store 20 years ago, there wasn't grades by wine magazines or whiskey magazines on different types of varietals, recommendations to have with what kinds of food.
Wyoming State Liquor Association lobbyist Mike Mosier says people are demanding more options and buying more alcohol overall. He says they're not necessarily drinking more, they're drinking better.
Our tastes are becoming much more refined. We're buying more quality product, and we're developing appreciation for that product, which is good for everyone.
It's definitely good for Wyoming's coffers. Over the past 7 years, the amount of liquor and wine that passed through the warehouse increased 24%, and the amount of money collected from standard markups and excise taxes going to the state increased 77%. The liquor division put more than $14 million into Wyoming's general fund in fiscal year 2012. To meet the increased demand, the Wyoming Liquor Division moved into a new warehouse, which was formally dedicated this month. Men on carts drive through aisles of scotch and gin, stopping to grab a single bottle here or several cases there for a specific order whenever the automated headsets they're wearing tell them to. Others load up pallets with individual orders that will be driven all over the state within the day.
Old warehouse facility was 100,000 square feet, and this new facility is 145,000 square feet. The old warehouse had 7 dock doors, and the new warehouse has 17 dock doors.
Wyoming Liquor Division Administrator Greg Cook says demand for more variety made the new space necessary. He says he's sometimes surprised at the intensity of the demand for some novelty items. When Wyoming Whiskey's first batch of bourbon was released, retailers bought out 3,000 cases of bourbon in under 4 minutes, leaving behind a long waiting list. And some Wyomingites are also willing to spend a lot on the good stuff.
It's kind of rare, but the liquor division sold one customer, I believe it was a Glenfiddich 50-year-old product that cost $18,000.
Cook admits those are anomalies. He says bars and package stores mostly order all the same products they used to. Whiskeys do particularly well in Wyoming, but tack on orders for new flavors and varieties as they're available.
These major liquor companies have figured out that introducing new products means more sales and a wide offer to a wide variety of customers, and that's why we're seeing what we're seeing.
Cook says as long as people keep buying them, he'll keep ordering them. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Rebecca Martinez.
When we come back, we'll hear cowboy poets sing. This is Open Spaces. This is Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. Wyoming is still a frontier of sorts, a place where many continue to hunt in wide open spaces. And sometimes they sing about it, too. Wyoming Public Radio's Irina Zhurov reports that Julian Saporiti is collecting those cowboy poet songs to share with others.
Julian Saporiti is not from Wyoming.
Like, this is how not Wyoming or Western I am. I've never ridden a horse in my life. I've never been on a horse. I've been on a pony ride going around in a circle in a grocery store parking lot when I was 6. That's the extent of my cowboyisms.
Saporiti is from Tennessee, and he came to the University of Wyoming for graduate school. Currently, the Department of American Studies at UW is working on an exhibit called The Art of the Hunt, about hunting in Wyoming and artisanal objects of the hunt. The curators wanted to create an emotional component to the exhibit, which is slated to open in 2014. Saporiti, a musician with an interest in ethnomusicology, thought song could easily do that.
I thought, how could I bring that expertise or aspiring expertise anyways to this project? And I thought there's got to be a lot of songwriters in this state, relatively speaking, who grew up hunting and how that affected their music and themselves as artists.
So he set out to find the cowboy poets of Wyoming.
My name is Hub Witt.
This fella Hub Witt had rented the Continental Breakfast Room in the Days Inn on the outskirts of Sheridan. The recordings, you can hear like the buzz of the juice machine in the background.
Witt is from Wyoming, and he's been hunting, guiding, and singing here for decades.
He's got a wood leg, and at one point he stood up, and the photographer noticed that he had like a semi-automatic handgun tucked into the back of his pants. I guess he needed it on the ranch or something where he was working, but it was just like this amazing juxtaposition of this one-legged, gun-wielding, dressed to the nines cowboy singing songs to us in a Continental breakfast room of a Days Inn. For my first month in Wyoming, this was an amazing experience. He had some amazing stories and some good songs.
Witt told a story from his guiding days in the late 1980s when he had to kill a bunch of horses because they didn't get out of camp in time before a big snowstorm came in.
We got everything packed up and we had to cross the Yellowstone River. Some of those horses were so bad they couldn't get out of there. The only thing we could do was shoot him.
Witt's songs are clearly an extension of these experiences and the Wyoming landscape. He says where hunting and songwriting intersect for him is in the detail, in close observation during a hunt, in meticulous descriptions, in a song. His song Thoroughfare River, which has never been recorded, is one he wrote for another guide about going out.
On the Thoroughfare River, in the mountains at home, your sweetheart is waiting down there by the phone. She's hoping you're happy, that's all she has.
Saporiti said the songs he recorded were rarely about hunting per se.
It would be songs involving hunting, songs that took place on a hunt, music that they played while guiding hunts. So it was a lot of the periphery of the hunt. If hunting is like such a big passion, parallel to music, it's almost like two things that fill the same spiritual place in you.
He also said the cowboy poets he met during his field work were vastly different. Dave Munsick has been in Wyoming for 30 years. He's a high school science teacher in Dayton and has been a professional musician since he was 15. When he was learning to play, he took inspiration from everyone from John Coltrane to Bob Dylan, Bach, Charlie Pride, and old-time fiddling.
Live a little while the way that real women do. Flies that float, flat-bottom boats, they'll make you go the way that you want them to.
He's moved away from hunting more towards fly fishing.
The parallels that he drew were, in fly fishing, you have to take a step back sometimes. It's just not working. That one spot isn't working. You can't just keep going until you have to take a step back, look at the whole river, and then you'll have success. He said that's exactly how his songwriting is sometimes. You just can't hammer home a verse.
Munsick plays in a band with two of his sons.
Like the Sundance of the Sioux and the medicine bag nobody sees. Sweet grass braided by the crow, a hunt for the white buffalo, and everything I'll ever need. Medicine to me.
Saporiti says as an outsider and a non-hunter, he went into the project with perhaps romanticized notions of what he'd find in Wyoming. And though he's conscious of such notions, he's also not too worried about them.
I think life could just use a little bit more romance, to be honest with you. You got to be objective, certainly, and keep that as a tool in your arsenal. But for anyone out there doing, covering people, you know, don't be afraid to be affected by these people. And just make note that you are and realize it. I think the truth is romantic a lot of the time.
Brian Ragsdale, who's from a Wyoming family of miners and ranchers, might agree.
She calls her home.
For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Irina Jorhoff.
Wyoming raised, Montana made.
Thanks for listening to this edition of Open Spaces. You can find archived editions of the program on our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. There you can listen to this and other programs and listen to individual segments as well. Tara Orr is our web editor. We also invite you to submit story ideas and essay pitches through that same website. We'll be back with you again on December 28th as we listen to some of our favorite segments of the past year. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.